As long as you want.
I went to go find one yesterday, but I wasn't able to do the 18 on my mic.
Oh, that's great. So, I love it.
Actually, I was getting too
I hope it actually is recording. Like, listening to it. Should be good.
Alright guys, now would be the time to start those machines up on the table if you need to. And as soon as everybody's back away from the table, we will bring in the sound.
Which was actually much better than
that. Yeah, of course. I would prefer that.
A lot less pressure.
I would prefer that. But hey,
okay, guys, look down. Take a spot. All right, once again, as they are seated, please welcome Michael Gambon, Steve Clovis, David Heyman, David Barron, and David Yates.
Michael.
I wanted to ask, I guess, David, David Yates, and Steve Clovis especially, do you think people need a primer coming into Harry Potter 6? Is it, you need to know who everyone is? The movie is so fast and well-paced, it doesn't seem to have time for introductions or a backstory or anything.
Do you know, it's really interesting. We have conversations about that all the time, basically, about how much exposition do we have, ultimately. And I think very early on we talked about the notion of putting this story in the moment and allowing the audience to just parachute in and go with it. And they're really, I mean, Steve will tell you much more about this than I, they're really tricky books to adapt because there's so much plot and there's so much detail that Joe weaves into this world. So it's actually really hard making those decisions about what's left in and what's left out. But ultimately, I think, we've got to that phase in these movies where I think we all feel it's a good thing to just kind of get the audience to buckle in and go, and not necessarily weigh them down with too much information about what's gone before. They can always go back to the DVDs, they can always go back to the books, and we are kind of trading a little bit on what's been there before, but we hope they, you know, forgive some of the leaps that we make.
I also think that there's some aspect of Joe's books which are so full of delights, and there's so much within them that actually you can, as David said, yeah, you have one experience if you have the knowledge of what has come before. But at the same time, there's another experience which is so rich and so pleasurable because of the gift of what Joe has given us and what Steve has so fantastically translated to the page, and he has directed. But I mean, I really think that's true of all the films, that you know, you have an experience which is fantastic if you are more familiar, and I think you can have a very good and rich experience otherwise.
Yeah, and I think I make the sort of initial judgment of how much freight the movie can carry. And I think at this point, there's only so much freight these movies can carry in terms of, you know, introducing characters and the like. But, so I make those decisions, and then we sit down and discuss it. Sometimes, do we need to introduce, you know, who Slughorn is or something like that? We have long discussions about it at times, and we have to kind of, but we have to make, ultimately, we have to make decisions so that the movie continues, even though 2.5 hours as it is. So I think we feel we need to make them lean where we can.
Well, of course, we all collect these movies on DVD and Blu-ray, so what is.
Thank you.
Well, there's a great set of the 5 so far, so what is.
There'll be a great set of the 6. And there'll be a great set of the 7, and then there'll be the ultimate collector's edition, and then there'll be another version. Worry not.
I was going to ask what's going to be on the DVD and what scenes look awesome in Blu-ray for 6, and will there be a 6 collection before we get all 7?
Worry not. One of the things that's going to be on the Blu-ray is that we've created some additional material with regard to the kids taking you around certain departments and interviewing people in those departments. Dan spends time in editing and with Mark Day talking about that. That's in the 6th Blu-ray and other such things. I haven't seen the final version of it all, but most certainly we've had a look at some of the materials, and I think it's really good. But well, I'm not sure. Also, we've taken some scenes that weren't included.
Yeah, one of the things we've included, I'm sure it'll probably be on the DVD Blu-ray. We had all these photographs of Slughorn taken for the movie. You know, these photographs in Hogwarts move. And so Jim Broadbent, who's a very gifted comedian and as well as actor, obviously, did all these wonderful improvisations for us. And we cut them together in a montage, which is really fun and entertaining.
Any favourite scenes on Blu-ray that
And we didn't actually cut that much out, I think, guys, did we? We were quite lean in what we kept.
In high
depth. It'll look beautiful. I mean, Bruno Del Bernal, who shot the picture, is just a real artist, and I know it looks. I think it'll look. I'm sure it will look absolutely beautiful.
I would have made that mistake.
David, Steve, what were the challenges this time around? Since this is the 6th film, was it easier? Was it harder? Since the groundwork has been laid already?
It's always hard. because, you know, I think we're all fans of the books, and I'm certainly a huge fan of the books, so I try to do the impossible initially and sort of put everything into the script, much to the annoyance of my collaborators. And then we had to sit down and, you know, I'll make some of the tough decisions, but then, you know, they help with some of the heavy lifting. And so I think this one was challenging in terms of that much of the book lived in the past. And David is, you know, very gifted at putting you in the moment, and I think it's where he wanted to put us in this movie. So a lot of our decisions really went from there. So we chose what memories to focus on, the ones that would most emotionally affect Harry and Dumbledore, and inform the audience about Voldemort's past and the mystery that lies at the core of this movie.
There's something, I read Steve's first draft on a plane on the way to Chicago where we were doing the testing for Order of the Phoenix. And I took it out, I was halfway through finishing off Order of the Phoenix with David and David, and you know, it was a very stressful time because we were about to show this first audience a cut of Order of the Phoenix. And I pulled this draft out of the bag, and Steve's first drafts are, you know, when you develop films or when you read scripts, you know, first draft is not always the best, but there's something about the work, the amount of work that Steve puts into a first draft. And I have to say, it was so exciting reading it, because the tonality and the spirit and the mood and the heartbeat of the film was absolutely there. You know, and that's what he always does, which is a real thrill for us.
It was amazing being on the plane. You know, we were on that plane, weren't we? And just David's reaction to it, because he had actually finished it before I did, and David did. But he was bouncing. It's like, this is... Because it's so different to any of the films that have come before, and I think therein lies one of its great pleasures. And Steve is so brilliant at creating, at bringing Joe's characters to life for film. And...
You know what he did? Personally, you know, I read a lot of scripts. Well, when I have time, I read a lot of scripts. But one of the things Steve does, which I think is a real gift, is he doesn't just write for the characters. He writes for the actors playing the characters. He knows their strengths. He knows their weaknesses. And I think he even writes for me sometimes. I think he knows what I'm good at. And that's very rare quality. I think he's hugely empathetic. He knows what's on the table. And he's not... just got a great ear for Marnie and Harry, and he's got a good ear for Dan and Emma, you know. And that's, I think that's very, you know, it's a special gift in my view.
Hi, I'd like to know, this question is for Mr. Yates. Tom Felton put his performance down to you, and I'd like to know, how is it that you get not only Tom, but the trio to get into those dramatic parts? What process do you use to help them get there?
Do you know, I think it's an understanding between us that my ambition for them is for them to just be the best that they can be. And I want people to watch them by the end of this series of films and to see what great actors they are. That's my... And they understand how ambitious I am for them, and they're equally ambitious for themselves in terms of their acting craft. So we're on this constant push. And one of the things that's just naturally happening because they're getting older is outside of the film set, in the real world, you know, they're finding things in their lives, you know, enlightenments and bruises and sort of a knowledge of the real world. And I encourage them to bring that to the set. And it kind of means that their work is getting that bit deeper and that bit more interesting and that bit more intuitive. You know, so I'm benefiting from the fact that they're getting older, but equally I push them very hard. You know, and they trust me, actually. And I also encourage them to be authors of their own work. I want them to participate in the process when we're on the floor, and they know I'll listen to their ideas, and I'll tell them when their idea is rubbish, but I'll also tell them and embrace them when I think the idea is great. So we have a very good rapport, I think, that's based on trust and the shared ambition to just make sure they're really, really good. That's what we want. I think that's what we all want.
Yeah. Daniel was saying to us just earlier that one of his most memorable times in film so far was diving up through the water and seeing you standing there in a ring of fire. He'll never forget that. I wondered, what are your memories of working with Dan on this picture especially, because you have a wonderful relationship.
What, in that section of the film?
Anything you remember?
Oh, just the fun we have. Dan and I get on very well together. We have to in this film, because he sort of takes over and I get weaker. And that's the way it works, and we... Every time we do a take, we have to make a break, we go outside and laugh, and we come back and do another scene, another bit of the scene. So it sounds a bit churlish, but I've deliberately developed a relationship with Dan in order to achieve some harmony between us, some contact. I think that's the only way you can do it.
And they're both great storytellers. So,
both tell
lies. Except, you can believe Dan's stories a lot more than you believe Michael's.
Michael, hi, we're here. I'm wondering, what will you miss or not miss about Dumbledore's costume? And have you snagged anything from the set that you will cherish?
I can't take anything off that set. We've all tried. We were prop men are so tough. You know, everyone wants a wand, but you can't get a wand. You can't get anything. I think the only successful guy at that is Rickman.
Brilliant. Rickman, I don't know if you remember the sleeping bags in the third film, but one of those ended up in an auction somewhere. I mean, it's not exactly something you can sneak out, but somehow he managed to.
Well, the first part of my question, what will you miss or not miss about wearing that costume?
I'll miss everything. That costume, so. I mean, Richard Harris, when I saw the first two, he wore very heavy costumes, really. You can see the weight of them. My costume's made of silk. It's very fine. It's so easy to wear. It goes on in 2 seconds. I'll miss that.
Michael very cleverly conceals a packet of fags. A packet of cigarettes below the lower part of the gown.
I hide my cigarettes inside that gown. It's just great fun. I got the wardrobe department to put a little pocket inside.
Early on in the scene, there was the diner scene, and I was wondering whether there was any more to it that was cut out that's going to be on the DVD. With the love scene with the girl?
No, and that's the scene that Steve came up with. That's not in the book, is it? So, that's pretty much it in its entirety. I love that scene. I think it's really charming and lovely. And there's another great thing about Steve. He kind of, he interprets and adapts the work, but he adds all sorts of things.
I think Joe really feels like he has her voice, you know, and he understands it. So he has the confidence and comfort with the material to put things in that aren't in the books, yet really you're not even aware that it isn't in the book. It feels so organic.
Well, they often tend to encapsulate lots of things that are in the book and spread through the book, and Steve just manages to encapsulate them in a moment.
And Emma said that you're out of Hogwarts and it's some pretty magical things you've already done.
Yep. We've been shooting for 5 months, and the first movie is a road movie, basically. It's quite intense and very raw, and we're way away from Hogwarts, and it's a bit like three refugees being pursued across the landscape by these terrible Death Eaters, and it's fun. We're really enjoying it, actually. It feels very different. What was hard coming back to Half-Blood Prince, we finished it about a year ago or so. It's all less, but it's weird coming back.
It feels like a year because we're so immersed in the new one.
So the first one's very verite and documentary and edgy and on the road, and the second part two, is a big opera, basically, a great big epic with huge battles and very oddly moving, because it concludes the whole saga, really. So they're two very, very different films.
Will it be summer and Christmas then for next year?
It'll be fall 2010 and summer 2011. At least that is the current plan.
Steve, I'm just wondering, how do you envision yourself in this? I mean, are you the interpreter of the material, the adapter of the material? What do you see as your mission in the big picture here?
I just try to survive. I think, the first day I met Joe, which was about 10 years ago, we hit it off pretty easily, and we went for a walk. And she said to me, look, I know the movies can't be the books. I know there will be something different. But what's important to me is the characters and that you stay true to the characters. So, in a sense, I see myself as the sort of guardian of the characters. I want to make sure that their motivations and who they, the essence of them, is always maintained throughout. Changes will happen, and as you make changes in one film, that gets compounded when you make changes in the second film. So, I try to protect the characters and capture the essence of the books, but I try not to be too slavishly connected to the books when I think that it defeats the sort of drama of cinema. And we talk about it. We have long conversations about it. But I mainly just try to... characters what I've always been interested in all my work, so it hasn't changed with this.
It's been quite fascinating watching the evolution of these films. They are an expression of our modern mythology, really. and as such, they began sort of in the world of wizardry exclusively, and as they've progressed, the wizards have taken on more human qualities or more human concerns. There's, against this all, seems to be a big fight against something called the darkness, and they are constantly faced with trying to grapple with that and understand it and bring it to some kind of a conclusion. How would you define the darkness? What is the definition of the darkness, really, for us in terms of this mythology?
I think the things that Joe always celebrates, you know, are those positive values of respect and love for the outsider or the misunderstood. You know, there are the parallels with sort of Nazi Germany, with the Death Eaters and the, being the brown shirts. And so I think the darkness is when our society starts to fragment and find conflict rather than harmony, when the more vulnerable in our society are picked on and ghettoized, and you know, and I think yeah, it's those positive values that I love about her writing, which is you celebrate and you respect and you find love rather than conflict.
I think another thread that's always in her work is the choices you make in life matter. And, you know, whether you drift into the darkness is usually a matter of choice. You know, it's not just the gifts you have, it's how you use those gifts. And I think that's something we discussed quite a bit when we did this. One of the reasons there's so much comedy in this movie is that I think when you read about it, just, you know, as a writer, you try to figure out what are they fighting for? And one of the things they're fighting for is to have that first kiss with the girl that you like and to hold hands with the girl you like. And that's kind of why I think that all those feelings become more intense in times of war or in times when you're trying to fend off the darkness. And that's kind of why it's there in this, if that, you know, answers your question.
One of the biggest changes from the book seems to be getting rid of that big final battle at Hogwarts when the Death Eaters come in, and then also adding that fight at the Burrow over Christmas. And I'm wondering about the decision to, you know, take out that one scene and maybe replace it with the one at Weasley's house.
There was a few, two things. First of all, it felt like the middle of the story needed an injection of jeopardy and danger. That doesn't exist in the book, but when we read that first, when we were sort of developing the script, it felt like there was a lot of comedy and a lot of lightness, and as a rhythm, it kind of felt like it sort of continued for too long. And so putting some jeopardy right in the middle just felt kind of, it would just remind the audience that the world beyond Hogwarts is still a very dangerous place, and it would put us back in terms of just the sort of outside narrative staying fresh in the audience's mind. And then the end, we all know there's a huge battle coming at 7. We're all looking forward to it. We're designing and planning it at the moment, and we wanted to sort of keep our powder dry for that, really, to sort of wait till 7 part 2.
The other reason why for the attack in the middle was in the book, there's lots of description of what the Death Eaters are up to and people getting killed, mostly told through newspapers and reports. And we felt it was important that there be some sort of tangible expression for that, so that our kids weren't reading it and hearing about it secondhand. It wasn't just about their friend at school who's going home because something's happened, or they read about it in a newspaper. It was about actually experiencing it. So the fact that the Death Eaters attack something that is so precious to Harry and Ron, the Burrows, that they are made vulnerable, made the danger feel much more real and immediate.
Yeah, and I think we wanted to show sort of how the Death Eaters operate, which is they instill fear in people, and not necessarily even doing anything other than, you know, scaring them. And this spreads, and it becomes, it's almost, it's what Dumbledore says at one point, you know, fear of name increases fear of the thing itself. And that they don't really even need to hurt someone to spread fear. And then, so you can extrapolate from that moment that they've done this a lot. And it's why people live in fear in the wizard world.
In the end of the last book, there's a flash forward in time. There was a, for the characters, there was a rumor on the internet that you guys might possibly be CGing the current actors to look older. Is there any truth to that, or will you be swapping them out with totally new actors?
You know, we're still exploring how we're going to deal with that. It's an absolutely beautiful part of the book. And one of the most unique things of this franchise, I guess, is the fact that you've grown up with these characters. And I think it's what makes it special for the audience. And so we will be delivering that at the end of part 7, part 2. But we're looking at various options of how we do it. And we still haven't quite figured it out yet.
Sorry?
Probably not Benjamin Button technology. We did look into that. but we don't think it's the route we're going to take.
Yeah. But a lot of Benjamin Button was making them look younger. And we're taking people who are 20 years old and making them look like they're in the late 30s. So that's a different experience. I mean, we may use some of the techniques that Benjamin Button. We're still, as David said, in an exploratory stage. But we're going to do everything we can. And it will be Dan, Rupert, and Emma in those parts, not some other actor.
I was surprised to see how many scenes there were that really could have easily fit into a romantic comedy, and even more pleasantly surprised to see how well they worked. Steve, can you take us through the process of scripting those scenes, and David, directing the actors in those scenes, and then editing it all together to make it affect the pacing of the movie?
I always look for comedy. I think, you know, which one of the great things about working with David Yates is that David likes to do the comedy. I've sometimes written comedy in the past that hasn't found its way into the movies or has been cut, because it's sort of the first thing to go. David sees it as vital, and that's great for me, because it's one of the things I think it makes the darkness all that more powerful when you see it contrasted with light. And I think also Dan, Rupert, and Emma now can play the sort of nuance of the comedy in a way that they couldn't have, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. So to write for them is not that different than, say, writing for Michael Gambon, which is, you know, quite a statement. And so it's different for me now. I can kind of give them almost anything to do, and then, you know, let David play with it.
And it was really sweet when Dan first read the script. He was in the middle of Equus, or he just bounced off Equus, which is and we've done Order of the Phoenix, both of which gave Dan the opportunity to do this really intense, tortured, fragmented sort of character stuff. And he walked into my office with this script and he said, "David," and it was almost accusatory, he said, "This is funny." "Yeah, Dan, isn't that cool?" And he said, "Well, is it all right to be funny?" And I said, "Yeah, Dan, it'll be great to be funny. We should do funny, it'll be good, you'll be good at it." And so they're just, as Steve says, they're at that age now where they're keen to sort of develop those muscles where they can try different things. And I think they're all quite naturally good at it, you know. And, you know, in terms of the rom-com element, you know, outside of our set and the work that we do, as I said earlier, they're going through all sorts of things in their own lives. And the most important thing to do is make sure that we execute those scenes with as much truth as we can, you know, to just make it feel as real as we can. And that means that when we hit the dark stuff, you know, if it's funny because of the character. It's coming from character, it's coming from a real base. And then when we hit all the darkness, it feels like we're not in a different movie. So that's the way we approached it.
And one thing, dark is easier than light, at least for me as a writer. It's much more challenging to try to make things slightly comic. It's one of the things I love about what Michael does, is that he finds that just that little twinkle and that little moment within a line or something, and does it with such nuance and subtlety. And it's much harder, I think, than doing, you know, it's pretty easy to do dark and grim and over and over and over.
Steve, was knitting patterns in the book, or is that yours?
That's in the book.
It's in the book, all right.
But you think one of the I love that both Steve and David do is and David sort of hit on it is it's not really about gags, it's not about boom, it's about finding the truth and the pain at times, which is often the source of great comedy. And I think in this film, you know, you really can feel the discomfort of the scene where Ron sits down between Harry and Ginny. And you can feel that, you know, it hurts, or you can feel the grasp, you know, the pain of loving someone but, or being interested in someone but not able to express it, and finding comedy in that, in the truth, as David talked about, as opposed to, you know, tripping over and landing on your face, but doing it in a, but they do that all the time, but in a much more realistic way.
Yeah, it is true. Sometimes we, David, Hayward and I actually think that David should perhaps play the comedy a little more on the front foot, but actually invariably he's absolutely right, because it's it is played on the back foot. It is completely and totally true to the characters. Actually, it's just as funny in a completely different way.
Question would be for Mr. Gammon eventually, but just a very quick one for you, Dave. Could you tell us at what point 7-1 and 7-2, at what point you both are going to break?
No. I could, but I'm not going to. No, I mean, we debated. I mean, it's been an interesting process, because actually when we began, all of us didn't want to make two films. And why do it now? And then when we, and it wasn't, but it was not something that was told to us that we had to do. It was just sort of an organic process of working on it, and Steve working on it. And, you know, the films really took a fundamental turn when I think Steve, working with Alfonso Cuarón, made the decision to tell the story from Harry Potter's point of view, as opposed to translating the books to film. At that point, there were sort of necessary omissions along the way. So something that we love, for example, like something like Spew, which is Hermione's interest in the house elves, we love that, but it is omitted because it wasn't part of Harry's story, and it allowed us to create a cinematic structure for the films, as opposed to, as I said, literally translating the books. The seventh book is a long book, but it is a book in which there's almost nothing that isn't related to Harry, and almost nothing that you can cut out. So Steve, working away in the vacuum of his house, was sort of struggling, I think, in some ways, to try and figure out what did he cut out. And we together, all of us, made the decision. I'm not kidding. I mean, I obviously the studio were rather happy at that decision. Let's not kid ourselves. But we made the decision to make two films. And Steve called me the other day and he said, you know, I think we could do three. I mean, he was joking, of course, but actually I think that there is so much material in this seventh book that making two films was the very best thing that we could have done for the book, and to adapt it in the right way. And in terms of where we're breaking it, you know, that you know, would like to hold that back for a bit. And actually, you know, we've made a decision right now, but, you know, because we're shooting the whole, both films as one, in a way, you know, we're shooting them together. We'll see what happens ultimately. I mean, I think the film is it's written in a very specific way, and that, I'm sure, will be where we end up. But I don't want to say now, and then all of a sudden we go, hmm.
Absolutely, absolutely. We do have an end point, but we'll kind of figure it out when we start editing, I think.
This is a follow-up to Mr. Heyman's comment about missions. Throughout the series, it's been a focus, like, the series has been focused on Harry, so I was wondering if you ever regretted a specific character being cut in the first six films. I'm not asking about Deathly Hallows, because it seems like everybody's been cast for the last movies. So in the first film, was there a specific character you truly regretted cutting?
No. Not in 5 and 6. I'm not sure about the others.
No, I mean, you know, I, as I say, there are things that I miss. You know, there's so many things that, you know, one of the things that I love about Joe's books is they're so detailed and so rich, and that every page has some jewel. Every couple of lines has some jewel that you hold on to. And one of the things I think Steve has done so brilliantly is, he's gotten as much in as he has, and I'm really proud of that. I think the films are very rich and detailed films, but there, you know, I would love there to be more. And every film, there's something you cut out that you go, oh, that's a shame. I wish we could film that, or I wish we could have that in.
Thank you.
At one point in the fifth film, we were going to cut out Creature. But when we showed Joe the script, she said, you know, I think that would be a very bad idea. She didn't tell us why, because the seventh book wasn't out. She said, I think that would be a very bad idea. So Creature's in, and he will be in the seventh film, too.
You guys talked about, or Mr. Yates, you said that part one is going to be a road movie. It's taking a big departure from the past Potter films and that they're all at Hogwarts. Are you guys concerned at all that fans who, maybe they're fans of the movies, maybe not so much of the books, maybe, are you guys concerned they will be a little turned off by it, how it's not at Hogwarts, it's going to be a lot different. Is there anything you may be including to keep that Hogwarts feel to it, or what?
I think the franchise benefit, I think the audiences will respond to us being as fresh as we can with each of these films. I think what audiences probably won't respond. I believe you've got to kind of keep things as fresh and as different each time as you can. And one thing that really excites us about what we're shooting at the moment is it feels very different to where we've been with Half-Blood Prince and very different to Order of the Phoenix. And it just feels like everything. And I think the one constant is the fact that you're with these characters you really care about and you've grown up with, and you know, we still have magic, so that all the characters are constant, but the whole thing is evolving and maturing, and I think that's a good thing. And I don't, rather than switching fans off, I think it keeps the thing nourished and alive, I would say.
Can I say a couple of things in response to that? And this is not meant to sound arrogant in any way, but we really sit there, when we're making the films, we are making, what we're trying to do is make the very, very best films we can. And it's not like we're responding to, oh, you know what, we should put something from Hogwarts in because that's what drew them to the film. We want to be as faithful to the spirit and make the very best films we can. And we're all incredibly ambitious for these films. And I think we are avid fans ourselves. So it's not like we look outside of ourselves. We're actually looking at ourselves and asking the questions about what works and what doesn't. And ultimately, we just want to tell a really good story. That's one. And two, when I first read the book in 1997, the first book, what drew me to it, yes, there was fantasy, but I'm not really a fantasy fan. Yes, there was magic. I love magic, but that wasn't what drew me to it. What drew me to it was that it was characters who I really enjoyed and who I could relate to in some form or other. And yes, there was an institution that was familiar, you know, a school institution. We'd all been to school and had teachers we liked or didn't like. But what really got me were Harry, Ron, and Hermione and their friendship. And I think Steve has done the most incredible job in keeping that fresh and alive and true and investing myself, because I can speak very particularly about that, in these characters in a really extraordinary way. And I feel that David Yates in his two films and in the work that he's doing now does exactly the same. And I think that audiences will love the seventh film, part one, because it is different, but because it's really about these characters who we all care so much about.
What kind of thinking, planning, and crafting goes into negotiating the crossover worlds between children's sensibilities and teen sensibilities to connect with both worlds at the same time?
I can speak for myself. In writing, I don't think of an audience at all. Because I have children and I respect children. I think they can handle much. I think sometimes we're, I don't know how I say it. I try to just give them the best experience I can. There are times where someone might, you know, we might discuss some content of the script, but it's very rare. It's there in Joe's books. And I never feel any pressure to appeal to any particular audience. Never have. But that may be more my way of working than anything else. I've always been that way.
In a way, just going back to what we were saying before, Joe really is the touchstone. And we just do the very best we can with that material. And it's not about thinking, that audience, or that audience. You know, it's so funny, this film's got a PG rating, whereas the two previous ones got a PG-13. I don't know what the MPAA were thinking, but it wasn't a conscious decision to be lighter, to be darker. It's just what Joe has given us and what Steve has adapted and David directed. It's not directed towards a specific audience. We're just making, adapting these books and, you know, as passionate fans.
Yeah, I don't think we're that smart to figure that out anyway. Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.